Hello there, welcome back. Today we're going to be talking about the 10 plagues. I love a good sci-fi story or a good fantasy story. Lord of the Rings is one of my favorite books, series, and you know the movies too. They actually did it right. Another one that I really like is The Mummy, and the modern one. Now, not the latest one, the one with Brendan Fraser. That was a really good one. I know it wasn't the best acting, but it just had a good story and it had a good feel to it. And so it was neat that way. But there is definitely something that they got wrong. And I realize it's fantasy and they weren't trying to create a biblical model of what happened, things like that. We understand that, you know, I know it's fiction and it's pretty good. But one of the things that they got wrong that really is ironic is that this mummy had all this power to do these things, and it was his power. He's the one that could cause the flies to come. He had the swarm, the locusts, and all kinds of powerful things that no human can do. But this is what the alchemy and the sorcery of Egypt came up with way back when. Now, I have no doubt that the Egyptians were some pretty amazing people back then. You know, the fact that they could build the pyramids, and I don't know the timing of everything, and I think there's a lot of people who are very confident in the timing, and that's great for them, but all I know is that those pyramids were built, and they were built at a time where they shouldn't have been able to build those things. I mean, I don't even know if we can build them right now. So there's some pretty amazing things that they did. I don't believe that they could cause all kinds of miracles to happen, though. Even we'll talk about a little bit that with their sorcerers and things like this. They could do some things, but they were basically magic tricks. And I don't know how they did some of the things that they did. But I do know that the plagues had nothing to do with the power of the Egyptians. It had everything to do with the power of God. And that's it's a very ironic thing, because the whole reason that God created the plagues to begin with was to prove that he was God above all their gods. All their other gods were fake, but he is the one true God. And he is the one who created these plagues so that he would prove himself. And it's pretty ironic that they would depict the power of the Egyptians as the ones that created their plagues. Well, like I said, I know it's fake. I know it's all meant to be fiction, and I'm not being critical of the film. Like I said, I enjoy it, but it is a great way to start to think about who it is that actually did those things. And it was God. And there's no question about that. And we're going to talk about, this is from Exodus chapter 7 through 12, looking at the plagues, and I want to go through the plagues. I want to see what they were and what they said, what each statement was in there, and some different tidbits in there. And then we'll go at the end. I'll have seven fundamental observations about the plagues, things that we can learn that we could even apply to ourselves today. So let's go through this and let's find out what God is teaching us. Now, as we get into this, though, we need to start with chapter 7, verses 1 through 3. And this is where God told Moses and Aaron that he's going to harden Pharaoh's heart. He said, I will harden Pharaoh's heart and multiply my signs and my wonders in the land of Egypt. And these will be described in verse 4 as great judgments. Now, these are judgments that God is making against Egypt and also against the gods of Egypt, their beliefs, their system of belief. Egypt had for a long time been building their system of beliefs. They've been creating and worshiping gods. They even were getting to the point where Pharaoh was considered to be a representation of the sun god Ra. And even his child, his firstborn, would have been considered deity. And of course, Pharaoh was considered deity as well in some kind of a strange way. He was the one that would get up in the mornings and he would be the one who would raise the sun. He would have a ceremony so that the sun would come up that day. And that was his power, supposedly, and that's what they attributed to him. And so every morning he had to get up and bring up the sun. Well, I know that that man didn't believe he could raise the sun because, but I also you know, I mean, how could he do that? But at the same time, I kind of wonder if he would have thought, well, what would happen if I actually don't do this? And, you know, that would have been a burden, right? And it's hard to get up early anyway, but to have to get up before the sun so that you can raise the sun so everyone would be there, that's some audacity, really. If you kind of buy into that, there is some pride issues there. But we're going to see that Pharaoh had a lot of pride. And that kind of goes in with who he is and what the problems are in Egypt at this time. As I've said before, I'm not good with history. I don't know the timing. I don't know when this was, what Pharaoh this was. And to me, it doesn't matter. What matters to me here is what the message is from this text. And I know that the Pharaoh was Pharaoh. And I know that Egypt was the land of Egypt. And that this was a mighty superpower of that day. And God is bringing judgment upon the nation because of the false gods and the false ideas that they had. So God here is about to bring judgment upon them. He's going to deal with their sins, and he's going to expose their gods as nothing. And the intention, of course, was to show the world that God's power, to show them his majesty, and hopefully for everyone to turn to him. Back from their false gods. It's amazing how he knows exactly what to do, not just for me or for you, but considering the needs and the understanding of everyone on earth at the same time, he can do what's best in order to affect everyone in their place of understanding where they are. He has that amazing ability, and that's what's going on here in this chapter as well. He's going to help the Egyptians. He's going to help to create faith. He's going to help the Israelites to create faith. He's going to build up Moses in the eyes of the people so that when he gives the law of Moses, they will follow him. There are a lot of things going on here, a lot of plates spinning, so to speak, and God is the one who's orchestrating all these things. Now, Moses, when he approached Pharaoh, was 80 years old, and Aaron was 83. That's Exodus chapter 7 and verse 7. And God gave a sign to Pharaoh through them in verses 11 through 13. But his magicians did something similar. In verse 10, it says, "So Moses and Aaron went into Pharaoh, and they did just as the Lord commanded. And Aaron cast down his rod before Pharaoh and before his servants, and it became a serpent. But Pharaoh also called the wise men and the sorcerers to the so the magicians of Egypt also did in like manner with their enchantments. For every man threw down his rod, and they became serpents. But Aaron's rod swallowed up their rods, and Pharaoh's heart grew hard, and he did not heed them, as the Lord had said." So that's an interesting passage. Now, that has nothing to do with the plagues, although it shows mindset that's already there. And God is already trying to get him to admit, hey, there's something going on here. But because of these false teachers, these false religious people coming in with their magicians and the sorcerers, bringing them in, they're able to conjure up some things, and it looks similar to what God presented. And doesn't that show you the dangers of false religions? You know, so many people are in religious, their religions, they're copying God's ideas, they're making them their own, and they're changing the message of God into something that they're attempting to use to actually overthrow him. Think about, for example, what's happening in psychology. Now, I'm not coming down on psychologists per se, but we do know that sometimes this kind of thing happens. And there's many other areas of science where it happens too. So you take pieces of the Word of God. And, you know, the thing about the Word of God is even if you have a partial obedience, you just take some of the principles out, those can have a huge difference in your life. So they attempt to explain life without God using those principles that God actually taught and has taught humanity for thousands of years. They use those and pretend it's theirs, and then they can try to convince you that it's these principles that are at work. It's not God who's taught these things. It has nothing to do with God. Scientists do the same thing. For example, they create materials and they design things based off nature, while they are denying that there was any intelligence behind that nature. So they may copy various things that they see in the world around us, and that's beginning to be more and more popular in the scientific world, because they're using these natural designs and recreating them in laboratories and recreating them in the way that they create, you know, they maneuver and the atoms that they're creating. For example, some cars are designed after certain fish. Submarines use some of the same technology that they find in underwater fish. And there's a lot of things that we copy from nature, but it's very difficult for them to admit that there's any intelligence behind it. It just happened to be that way, and we're going to copy off of that. Well, that's kind of a similar idea when you have people who are claiming to do miracles and claiming to do things in ways that God has done, imitating God, and yet they're using those things to teach contrary to what God says. That's definitely what was going on here. I don't know what these magicians were. It seems to me like they just kind of conjured up some things, because they did a couple of things that, Aaron, like he threw down his rod and it became a snake, and the other ones did the same thing. And there's people that have said, well, you know, there's a certain kind of reptile. If you snap it, it'll kind of stiffen up like a board. And then when you do a certain thing, it'll go back to normal. And you can kind of fool someone into thinking it's like a staff or something. I don't know if that's true or not, but I do know that in some way they conjured up this stuff. I don't believe that they had the ability to take a stick, a literal piece of wood, and cause it to become a serpent. But even if they did, the message is pretty plain, because Aaron's serpent swallowed up the other serpents, so showing it to be greater. So that's, you know, even if they could do those things, there's still nothing in comparison to what God has. So this is where we are now, where Pharaoh's heart is hardened, and it's going to continue to harden. Every time that there's a plague, Pharaoh's heart is going to be hardened even more. And so let's get into the 10 plagues that were brought to Egypt. The first one was turning the river into blood. That's chapter 7, verses 14 through 23. Now that's a huge deal, because, of course, you know, the Nile is their source of life. That's where all of their water comes from. And so their whole economy is based upon the water that's there. Their whole livelihood, their life is tied to that, because that's where they get their water. And Moses and Aaron confronted Pharaoh, and they turned the Nile to blood. Now, that is something that would have been incredibly, smelly, for one. So talked about all the fish that died, and of course they couldn't live in that. And there are some people that believe that this wasn't literally blood, that it was simply red algae or something like that. And it's possible that turning to blood could be said in a way, or it could be a figure of speech saying that it looks like blood. I don't know for sure, but I do know that it changed, and it was such a bad change that the fish of the sea died, and the smell was horrendous. So I have no reason to think that it couldn't have been blood. And so whatever happened, God did it, and it was a miraculous thing. And since it was a miraculous thing, it could have been blood. It could have been red water. I don't know what it was, but it certainly turned to blood, as it says. Now, that's pretty amazing. By the way, I got some things from research. One of the best places I found for answering some of these questions about the gods of Egypt that I'm going to be going over is a place called gotquestions.org. And I found a lot of great material there. I don't know about that site. I'm not endorsing the entire thing, but I do know that there's some good stuff that was here, and I've seen it kind of repeated in different places and different commentaries and things, some of the things that they said. So I have a very good feeling that of accuracy here when I'm looking at other things, but this is where it was very well organized, gotquestions.org. Now, the Egyptians worshipped the Nile. There was a god of the Nile called Apis, and Isis, you may have heard of, is the goddess of the Nile. There's one called Khnun, which was the guardian of the Nile. And so for these, the god of the Nile, the goddess of the Nile, and the guardian of the Nile to be overthrown like this, they had no control over what God was doing. They had no way of protecting the people. And this is what they counted on these gods to do, to bring the Nile water in, to make sure everything's good, that they had plenty of resources and things from the water, and to protect that so it could protect them. The Nile was also believed to be the bloodstream of Osiris, who was reborn each year when the river flooded. And that was a yearly thing, that it would flood, and that would be part of the way that they would live, because in the floodplains, that's how they got the nutrients in the soil and things so that they could plant. They needed that. And so they considered that to be the bloodstream of Osiris, as they said. But being the Nile, even though they thought it was the bloodstream of Osiris, they had never seen blood in that bloodstream. And it shows the fallacy of their thinking. They couldn't take that literally, but they were. They were saying this is the bloodstream of Osiris and it's just water. It could be that this is part of God's judgment here, where in their, think about maybe what this says. It's possible that God is saying, you want to turn from me and believe in some fake God and call this river his bloodstream? I'll show you what a real bloodstream is rather than this fake one. So he gave them what they had longed for, what they'd continued to call the Nile was the bloodstream of Osiris. He made it literally that. There's some good irony there if you're a fan of irony, and I am. I love good irony. You know, but the thing is, the magicians in chapter 7, verse 22, they did the same thing. Now, the river had already been turned. And in fact, it was the people had to dig around the river just to find water to drink. So evidently the water had seeped into the ground. That water had seeped into the ground previously had not turned to blood. It was only the water that was flowing inside the river itself. And so the magicians could not turn the river into blood because it was already blood. But evidently they had water from other source. Maybe they had a pitcher of water and they turned it to blood in using their enchantments. And that could be very well what he's talking about when he said that they did the same thing. You know, evidently they had water somewhere that they could change. It's highly unlikely that they literally did what Moses did, where he turned the whole Nile to blood, that God did that through Moses. It's very unlikely that they did that. So this is some kind of trickery that was done, but it was enough to convince Pharaoh that it was possible to fake it. That's certainly not clear thinking on his part. You know, it's a whole lot easier to take a bowl of water and fake turning it into blood than it is to turn the entire Nile and, you know, into blood. Those are very different things. But whatever they did, they conjured this up in some way so that Pharaoh hardened his heart and refused to let the people go. Another thing that we don't know is how long the river was actually full of blood. I mean, did it just fill up with blood one day and then it just flowed out and it was gone the next? Or did it last a full week? Because we know that the next plague didn't happen for a full 7 days. Was there still blood in the water when that plague, the second plague, started? It doesn't say when it ended, but it does say that it began. And so the second one is frogs. That's chapter 8, verses 1 through 7. Moses and Aaron confronted Pharaoh after a week, after 7 days, and gave him the warning that there would be so many frogs that they would invade everywhere. I mean, every place in the land would be covered with frogs, even their bedrooms and their kitchens. You can imagine what that would have been like. There is a frog-headed goddess named Hekat that was an Egyptian goddess. And I'm probably saying that wrong, but it's H-E-C-A-T. And this was the goddess of birth. And frogs were thought to be sacred. You weren't supposed to kill the frogs. So that's an interesting thing that happened. It's not like you can just go around killing these things to get rid of them, although they did die. But you wouldn't want to kill them. So you would have to just put up with them. You try to shoo them out, sweep them out of the house or whatever. But it would have been a big pain. In the plague, the frogs died and their bodies were piled in heaps. And it just stank everywhere, all throughout the land. You can imagine what it would smell like. They'd already had the river turned to blood and all the fish that had died and the stench that came up from that. And now they're having the frogs die. And it's almost like God is saying, you enjoy worshiping frog gods? Here, have some frogs. Because of the way they saw the frogs, they couldn't really do much about them. And this way, the frogs that they thought to be sacred and holy actually became a source of misery and stench. How fitting. God is showing them the ridiculousness of their philosophies and their religion. But the magicians did the same things. Now, considering the fact that they were already frogs everywhere, it doesn't seem very difficult for me to imagine how a magician could cause frogs to appear in a place, right? They were everywhere already anyway. But there was something that they did that convinced Pharaoh that this was just a magic trick. But there was something different here. They probably couldn't reproduce the miracle in the number of them, just in the fact that they could produce frogs out of thin air. We know there was something different, though, because of Exodus chapter 8 and verse 8. This is where a Pharaoh called for Moses and Aaron and said, "Entreat the Lord that he may take away the frogs from me and from my people, and I will let the people go that they may sacrifice to the Lord." So evidently, Pharaoh recognized there's something different here. There's something going on. I need to go ahead and take care of this. If the magicians really could control frogs like that, they could make them appear. Why couldn't they make them disappear? There was something different there. And so Pharaoh had to go and ask Moses, please take these things away. But even in Pharaoh's repentance, you can see his pride lingering in the background. We see this in verses 9 and 10 of chapter 8. And this is one of those amazing things about Pharaoh. Listen to what Moses said to Pharaoh and see how you would respond. Moses said to Pharaoh, "Accept the honor of saying when I shall intercede for you, for your servants and for your people, to destroy the frogs from you and your houses, that they may remain in the river only." So in other words, tell me when you want these things to stop, to go away. And I can take these things away anytime. You just tell me when. In verse 10, Pharaoh answered, "Tomorrow." And he said, "Let it be according to your word, that you may know that there is no one like the Lord our God." What pride. Here it is. He wants to do it his way still. And it just screams to me pride. Whenever Moses tells him, "All right, you can have these gone. I would want them gone right now. Say, let's do it right now." But he doesn't say right now. He doesn't say tonight. He says tomorrow. So he would rather sleep with the frogs one more night. There's some pride. His obedience to God still had to be somewhat on his terms, as if he actually had any control of what was happening, right? And God, he didn't rid the land of them. They all died there. They had to pile them up in heaps. And the land stank. What a reminder. But again, Pharaoh hardened his heart after there was relief. Yeah, I think you could probably see that one coming. He had the pride. It's not difficult to think that he wasn't genuine in his repentance. And then the third one is lice or gnats. Exodus chapter 8, verses 16 through 19. It was on everyone, on all the cattle in the land and all the people in the land. And literally the word is gnats, but the New King James Version says lice. And I didn't check. Other versions probably say that too. It's possible that the Hebrew word is generic and that the translator saw what was going on here and thought, well, these pesky things are really more like lice. It's more a specific word. But I don't know. I'm not a Hebrew scholar. Whether they were lice or gnats, it doesn't matter. What we're talking about is a miserable condition. And these things really were an indictment against Set, the god of the desert. And that's where it came from, the dirt, the dust. And the magicians couldn't duplicate this one. In fact, they called it the finger of God. And from this time on, they wouldn't duplicate any of the things that Moses did. But Pharaoh still hardened his heart all the more, even though his own magicians were telling him, this is really God doing this. This is not fake. This is the finger of God. Then we have the fourth one, that's flies. Chapter 8, verses 20 through 24. Now, there was a fly god, Ur, I guess is how you say it. It's UH. I want to say but this was an indictment then against that God, because God said, hey, you have a fly God, how about some flies? And that God couldn't do anything about it, because he's not real. But there also was, at this point, a distinction between Israel and Egypt. And this is the first time there was a distinction. The land of Goshen, where the Hebrews lived, that wasn't Egypt, but it was a separate land. They didn't have any flies there. And this is also the first time that Pharaoh said for them to go and to make their sacrifices. But he told them to make the sacrifices in Egypt without leaving. That's verse 25. So he's trying to compromise with God. And that's the thing, is God doesn't compromise. He wants submission, and he demands submission from Pharaoh. It's not enough for him to acquiesce and say, okay, you can do what you want, as if we can, you can have your God and I'll have mine, and we can just to kind of agree to disagree, and we can kind of respect each other's gods. And God says, no, there is one God. It's I who am God, and you will admit that, or you're getting more plagues. So there is no compromise with God. And Moses said that the Egyptians would stone them for sacrificing the way that God wanted them to sacrifice, so he couldn't stay there in the land. He had to leave. And so this is why the compromise wouldn't work. He consented to let them go then, but not very far. And then Moses prayed that the flies would leave, and then Pharaoh hardened his heart again once the flies left. Then we have the disease on the livestock. That was chapter 9, verses 1 through 7. This was an indictment against Hathor, a goddess, and Apis. Both of these were depicted as cattle. And God was slowly and steadily destroying the economy of Egypt. He was also showing his ability to protect the people that obeyed him. Because he separated, again, Israel from the plagues, starting with the previous one. And in this one, too, they were separated out. So they didn't have any disease on their livestock, but all the livestock that Pharaoh had and all the livestock of the Egyptians, those all had diseases, and a lot of them died. But Pharaoh's heart was still hardened. Even though Pharaoh sent people to find out whether or not the livestock of the Israelites were harmed, and none were, as God said, he still was hardened. If he was holding them there because of his fear of harming their economy, which we've discussed before, wasn't he doing worse by keeping them there? I mean, it was a whole lot worse for his economy than if he would just let them go. And it's going to get even worse now. You know, sometimes we hold on to things God wants us to get rid of. He wants us to let go of things. And it could be sinful things. It could be things that we just don't need, that we think we have to have a hold on to, that is really getting in the way between us and God. And we do that in spite of making things worse for ourselves. I mean, we may have a whole lot worse life because we just want to hold on to the things that we have instead of just giving them up. That's pride. And pride is self-destructive, and it's certainly showing that to be the case here. The sixth one is boils on humans and animals. That's chapter 9, verses 8 through 12. This is an indictment against the gods of health and disease. That it's Sigmet and Sunu, and also Isis fits in there as well. With this one, the magicians, they couldn't not only... It's not that they couldn't reproduce this. They couldn't already do any of the previous ones. But they couldn't even stand there before Moses, because they had boils on them just like everyone else, except Moses and the Egyptians, and the Israelites. But God hardened Pharaoh's heart even more by this. And this is where he reasons with Pharaoh. Chapter 9, verses 13 through 21, this is before the seventh plague, the plague of hail. He sent Moses to talk to him, and this is the basic message. If I wanted to kill you all, you would already be dead. He actually had proven that many times already. But he said, I don't want to hurt you. He said, I raised you up to show my power through you, that the earth would know me. But you've exalted yourself against my people, That's the message that he gave him. Now, it's possible that Pharaoh could have shown God's power through him by simply submitting to God and saying, "You are the king of all kings. You are the God of all gods. I submit myself to you, I bow down to you, and you can do whatever you want." That would definitely have shown the earth that God had power. But he exalted himself. Pharaoh exalted himself against his people, and now he's going to continue on even more because this is what's going to happen. And God knew it was going to happen. And he is then going to be able to show his might and his power so that all the nations in the world would understand what's going on. But he gave him a warning. He said, whatever livestock that you have left after this, the previous diseases, whatever livestock you've got left, take them and shelter them, because you're about to have hell, and it's going to be such hell like you've never seen before. And those who listened were spared, and those who didn't listen, they left their livestock in the fields, and the livestock died. This was an indictment against Nut, the sky goddess, and Osiris. Osiris was the crop fertility god, and also Set was the storm god. So hell fell down with thunder and even lightning. It says with fire, and it could literally be fire, as some people interpret it, but also could mean lightning too. I don't know, but it was something that was absolutely amazing, and it didn't do anything in Goshen again, but it did in all of the rest of Egypt. It struck down everyone and everything in the fields, both man and beast. They all died because of this. It broke all the trees. It struck down all the plants. That's how bad it was. It was heavy. It was huge. And God said, you've never seen anything like this before. You've never seen anything like it again. And Pharaoh admitted sin at that point. That's the first time he's ever said that he had sinned. In spite of the hardness of heart, he really is. It seems like he's taking steps toward doing what God wanted. But it just wasn't enough, because he kept allowing his heart to be hardened even more. As soon as the hell stopped, he went back to his hardened heart. So we have the eighth one. The eighth one is locusts. You can see that in chapter 10, verses 1 through 20. This is against Nut, or Nut, Osiris, and Set again. There were later crops of wheat and rye that survived the hell because it hadn't started growing yet. So he destroyed the earlier crops, and the later crops, wheat and rye, had been starting to grow up, and now they're about to be destroyed too by all these locusts. This swarm was worse than anything they'd ever seen in Egypt. You can see that in chapter 10, verses 5 and 6. It says that they would cover the entire earth, and you wouldn't even be able to see the ground. There were so many of them. They were everywhere, and they filled all their houses, and there's nothing that they could do. They would eat everything, and that was the warning. And at this point, in chapter 10, verse 7, Pharaoh's servants decided to get in on trying to change his mind. Listen to what they said in chapter 10, verse 7. How long shall this man be a snare to us? Let the men go, that they may serve the Lord their God. Do you not yet know that Egypt is destroyed? So their counsel was simply to let the men go. You know, at least let the men go, and you can keep the children and the women here, because if the women and children stay here, the men will come back for them. So they're not going to leave completely. So I said, at least let them do that. They understood what was happening. They understood what the result of all this was. Egypt, the greatest nation on the earth at that time, was in ruins. And it was nothing that any army did. It was simply God sending, by his little finger, great power upon them. So Pharaoh tried to compromise again. He asked Moses who would be going. And Moses said, everyone. And then Pharaoh said, go now, you who are men, and serve the Lord, for that is what you desired. And they were driven out of Pharaoh's presence. He said, that's what you desired. That was never stated. Moses never said, let me just take the men and let's go. He said, let my people go so that we can go worship the Lord our God as we're supposed to. Obedience is not done partially. That's not obedience. All of what God said must be obeyed. That's what obedience is. And God is not going to let Pharaoh get away with a partial victory. It's full submission or else. So God brought in the locusts. And all the land was covered with it, just like God said there would. They ate every plant that the hail had left. There was nothing green in the land. Now that's a scary thought. Everything is eaten up. That would be unimaginable for us. Pharaoh repented again, and God forgave again. In chapter 10, verse 20, it says, though, that Pharaoh hardened his heart all the more after the locusts were gone. So it was a very short-lived repentance. And then comes the darkness. Exodus chapter 10, 21 through 29. This is the ninth plague. Darkness was a statement against Ra, the sun god. The sun god was actually symbolized by Pharaoh himself. So this was a strike against Pharaoh as well. Remember I mentioned before that Pharaoh would go get up in the mornings and through ritual, he would raise the sun. Well, this is definitely showing that God knows that's all fake. God is the one who's in control of it. And it brought darkness. In fact, God said that he would bring darkness that could be felt. And no one knows what that means. I don't know how you can feel darkness, but there are a lot of theories about what that is. It could be that God brought in a huge sandstorm with heat so that they could feel that. I don't know. They do have huge sandstorms there. And it was so bad that they couldn't see anything for 3 days. I mean, the sun was blotted out. It could be that some people have suggested that the darkness there was created by thick fog. It permeated everywhere. You know, even if you lit a torch, you wouldn't be able to see because the light couldn't penetrate it. It is interesting that in Psalm 105, it talks about the plagues of Egypt, among other things. And this one was the first one that's listed in the plagues. And maybe that's because of the severity of it compared to the previous ones. Now, I don't think it can touch the 10th plague, but this is a pretty severe one. And in fact, it says that the Egyptians they stayed in bed for 3 days. And they couldn't get out of bed anyway. They couldn't see anyone. There was nothing they could do. So they stayed in bed. What's that going to do for your economy, right? And I wonder how many days they've lost of work simply because Pharaoh wouldn't let these people go. But the children of Israel all had light in their places. So Pharaoh decides to compromise again. He says in chapter 10 and verse 24, go and take your kids, take care of all the people, but leave your livestock here. So he's figured, you know, they'll come back for that. But then how are they going to sacrifice, right? So Moses, he couldn't stand for that. Moses said, not a hoof shall be left behind. Exodus 10, verse 26. And that's what he meant. We're taking everything out there. And he said, we don't know what we're going to need until we get out there. We have to have everything there so that we know what to choose from. And if we don't, then we won't have anything to sacrifice anyway. We have to have the things with us. We have to have the animals with us so we can make our sacrifices. And then Pharaoh dismissed Moses, and he threatened Moses, said, the next time I see you, you'll be put to death. It's over at that point. What can God do at this point to change his mind if he's never going to even allow Moses to speak to him again? So in verse 29, Moses said, you've spoken well. I will never see your face again. And then we come to the death of the firstborn. And this one is absolutely horrifying, and had been building up. There had been nine previous warnings. Nine times God said, I am the God of the universe. You need to let my people go. He wouldn't do it. And now we have the death of the firstborn. This was a precision strike, I guess you could say. He didn't kill everyone. He killed the firstborn of every household. And it said that there wasn't a house in which that didn't have experienced death in some way. I'm assuming that the death of the firstborn meant children and not adults. But some people believe that it was adults. If you were a firstborn person, whether you're an adult or a child, you died that night. Pharaoh didn't die, but it's possible he wasn't firstborn. I don't know. But there was death of the firstborn. Isis was the protector of children. And there was also then that strike against him, against that god, Isis. And if God is against us, wow, what a terrible thought. But who can protect us if God decides to destroy us? And this is exactly what Pharaoh is facing. And there was no warning for this one either. Remember, Moses, he had told Moses, don't ever come back here again. So no one knew. Now, it's possible that some of the Israelites told people, or maybe the people, the Egyptians or other people saw what was going on with the Passover, and they started asking questions. It's possible that people told other people, but Pharaoh didn't know. The leaders didn't know. They weren't told in advance like they had been before. And here's a unique situation where Israel was separated out, but only by an act of faith. They had to show faith in God in order to get through this one, unlike the other ones. The other ones, they just, since they were the children of Israel, they were exempt from the plagues. But with this one, they had to actually act in faith and perform the Passover. So we have the preparation for the Passover. This is kind of preparing the people for what's about to happen, and also actually preparing to, God's going to be looting the Egyptians with this. Moses told the people to go to their neighbors and ask for gifts of gold and silver. And this would have been their Egyptian neighbors, right? So they're going to evidently to just go around to the communities, people that they knew maybe, or just people in general, and say, would you give us a gift? God is about to let us go, I think is what they're saying. And we would love for you to give us a gift of silver and gold. God is asking for that, if you would. And God made it so that the people of Israel found favor in the sight of the Egyptians, and they gave them a lot of things. And this is how they plundered them. And also Moses was great. It says that Moses was great in the eyes of the Egyptians. And the people of Israel the people of Egypt respected Moses, even though he's the one that's, in a way, bringing all these problems. They had great respect for him. Now, it's possible that these people weren't happy with the way the Israelites were being treated. Pharaoh was the one who was doing all this. Remember, we talked about earlier how that the Israelite problem was really more of a problem that Pharaoh had, not necessarily the people of Egypt. Pharaoh came into power and didn't respect the people of Israel. But the Israelites had been living there for decades, maybe longer. And it depends on how you interpret some things. But they were there for a long time, and there weren't any problems with them before. But all of a sudden with Pharaoh, they started to have problems with them. And he started worrying about them being overpopulated and all those kinds of things. So he was the one that really had the problem with the Israelites. And I think he just wanted an excuse to enslave them. And now that they're enslaved, he can't let them go because his economy is going to be destroyed because of that. But the people really didn't control that. The people didn't evidently want that to be the case. Didn't care if they were if they were slaves. Didn't want them to be slaves because they were willing to give them all kinds of things. So this is how the Egyptians were plundered by an army that never drew swords or anything against them. And he warned them in chapter 11, verse 4, to be ready. He said, about midnight, God's going to go through the land of Egypt, and every firstborn in the land will die, from Pharaoh's firstborn all the way to the servants in the land. Even the firstborn of the animals were going to die, but not any in Israel would die. That's to show that the Lord was making a distinction. But that protection only came through faith, because they had to practice the Passover. Chapters 12, verses 1 through 24 tells them what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to take the lamb. They were supposed to sacrifice it at dusk, and they would take the blood and put it on the door frames. And they had to use hyssop that was to dab it up there. Everything had to be done in accordance with what God said. And then when God went through Egypt destroying the people, the firstborn, if he saw a house with blood on the doorposts, he would pass over that house. That's why they call it Passover. So there's no warning for the Egyptians that we see, but God struck down the firstborn that night around midnight. And so Pharaoh sent for Moses and Aaron and gave them the message, leave, get out of here, verses 31 and 32. And also in verse 33, it says that the Egyptians themselves urged them all to leave quickly. They thought that if they stayed any longer, all the Egyptians would die. So Israel left with the gifts of the Egyptians that they had already gathered before, and the slaves plundered the mightiest nation on earth. It also says there were a multitude of Egyptians and others, possibly other slaves wanting freedom. They also went with them. Chapter 12, verse 38. This was the beginning of the Jewish calendar at this point. So those are the 10 plagues. And you can see how God, in all seriousness, was telling these people, you have no gods. I am your God. Okay, what can we learn then about the plagues in general? These are general principles that are more easily applied to us. And we've seen some things, and we recognize that God is a God above all gods. There are no other gods. And we know that in general practice, but most of us don't worship gods, right? Or at least they're not gods that we put up in a living room somewhere. There are some observations, though, some general things we can learn about these plagues. And the first one I think that we need to learn is that God means what he says. He will do what he says he's going to do. And if it takes then the hardening of someone's heart for it to be accomplished, that's what's going to happen. Now, I know that Pharaoh hardened his own heart, but God is not afraid to cause people to be lost if that's what they choose to do. We have free will. We have the ability to choose. And Pharaoh at any time could have said, you know what, go ahead and let them go. And in fact, as it started mounting up, you know, it started stacking up against him, he should have understood his economy is already ruined. All he had to do is let them go. There was no reason for him to let them stick around anymore, except for maybe he thought they would help him rebuild. But it's all been destroyed. And for what? Because of his pride. God means what he says, and he will not accept anything except less than what he says. The second thing to recognize is that people will suffer because of the sins of their leaders. I mean, that's how life works. It may not be great. It may not be, may not seem fair, but that's reality. And we know that's the truth. It happens all the time. So be careful who you allow to lead you, right? Be careful if you're a leader to take care of your followers, because they're going to suffer for your foolishness. So be careful. The third, the gods were inventions to explain what God already controls. Romans chapter 1, verses 20 through 23 says that people chose to fashion their idea of God into images of the corruptible to try to explain reality. Instead of looking to God, they look to create their gods in their own image, in the image of corruptible things, to explain the world and the universe, and really to explain what is incorruptible. We can't take the physical and build it up to the eternal. We've got to start with the eternal concept and stay with it. Number four, God disrupted not just their religion, but their economy, their lifestyle, their health. All of that to get their attention. That's all it was about. Pay attention here. That's what he was saying to them. Look at who I am. Number five, how can we not see similar things happening today? I'm not saying that we're experiencing the plagues here, but I'm saying that we can see how God could be using different things to get our attention. Are we listening? And COVID is an example. It's shut down the world in a big way. I'm not suggesting that God created COVID or that he's punishing the nations. I don't know. But I do know that if God were to create something or to allow something to happen in order to get our attention, that definitely would fit into the picture of it. It also seems that our economy in some ways is growing, but people all over are still hurting from job loss, cut hours, all kinds of things. People are still hurting. All these things and a whole lot more maybe should remind us that God is the one in control. We need to turn to him for our help and our protection. Number six, in these plagues, God is still helping people build faith in him. And that's amazing. In some ways, these plagues were a punishment. And in other ways, they were simply discipline. He was training people to trust in him. He was teaching the Egyptians to turn away from their gods because he's the one that overthrew them. He's training the Israelites to put their trust in God, something they would definitely need in order to follow Moses. So God is working with the people, and as always, he's trying to build faith in him. Number 7, when our politics and beliefs get in the way of God's plans, we can be sure that he can overrule us at any time he pleases. I want to be right with God. President Reagan at one time said, "It doesn't matter whether or not God is on our side. It matters whether or not we're on his side. We need to do what's right. We need to please him in all things and not get into thinking that God is somehow on our side. No, we're either with him or we're against him. And when our beliefs get in the way of God's beliefs, he can and will overrule us, and it will be to our detriment. There's no obligation for God to forgive us. It's only because of his nature. There's no obligation that we have over him that forces him to forgive us for anything or to include us in anything or to bring us to heaven. There's nothing that we can do or say that would cause God to have to do those things. He does those things because that's who he is. And so we need to be very careful not to let our own plans and ideas get in the way of what God wants and make sure we're pursuing only the things that he says. Well, I hope those have been helpful for you. I think there's 7 good points. You can probably come up with a whole lot more. In fact, if you would like to send me your ideas, I'd love to hear from you. You can email me jason@sparksmore.com and let me know what you think. Let me know if you have any other points that you would like to bring up about any of these plagues or questions. Because I'm here to help. I want you to grow in the faith, and I want you to grow in your relationship with God and your love for him and for other people. And so that's what this is all about. Is there anything that I can help you with? Let me know. Jason@sparksmore.com. Thanks, and I'll see you next time.